Stephen Tree of the Promotion of Animal Justice Act, and that was one of the three pieces of legislation enacted in the year 2000. Now, the route was tabled in the National Assembly on the 9th of October last year and was subsequently referred to this committee for consideration and a report. Honourable members, please allow me to give you some information. Now, consequently, the Act was enacted, and the aim of the Act, that is now the PAJA, is to create a culture of accountability, openness and transparency in the public administration, but also to promote an efficient administration and good governance by giving effect to the right to admin justice. Now, as indicated in Section 33 of the Constitution and the Act, both deal with just administrative action, which in general terms, first of all, refers to decisions by organs of state when exercising public power or performing public functions. For example, a decision of an administrator of the Department of Social Development regarding an application for a social grant will be an administrative action. Now, Section 33 of the Constitution and the Act mainly seek to ensure that the administrator has the necessary authority to make the decision. Secondly, that the right procedures are followed. Thirdly, that the decision and the reasons for the decision are made known to the person concerned. And then lastly, in the event of the person being dissatisfied with the decision, to ensure that there are procedures in place to have the decision reviewed by a court of law. Again, something which the rules endeavour to do. Now, let us look at the rules for judicial review. It's Section 7.3 of the Act that requires the Rules for Courts of Law, which has been established in terms of Section 2 of the Rules for Courts of Law Act of 1985. That board must make and implement rules of procedure for the judicial review of administrative action. Now, what is the procedure for making rules? Section 7.5 of the Act provides that any rule made in respect of judicial review must, before publication in the Gazette, be approved by Parliament. Therefore, the rules were tabled in the National Assembly and the National Council of Provinces. Now, let's have a look at courts having jurisdiction. Section 6 of the Act provides that any person may institute proceedings in a court for the judicial review of an administrative action. In terms of Section 1 of the Act, court means the constitutional court under certain circumstances, the High Court, and the Magistrate Court. However, Section 7.4 of the Act provides that until the rules which are now before this committee come into operation, all proceedings must be instituted in the High Court. Thereafter, persons may also lodge applications with the Magistrate Court, which would undoubtedly enhance access to justice. Now, the history is as follows. During November 2002, the then Rules Board submitted rules in terms of the Act to Parliament. However, these rules were not approved. Inter alia, due to the fact that the then Portfolio Committee on Justice and Constitutional Development was of the view that the procedures were not streamlined, were not appropriate or desirable, and were too onerous on administrators. In 2006, the Rules Board again submitted rules in terms of Section 7.3 of the Act to the Minister for approval in tabling in Parliament. On instruction of the Minister, the rules tabled in Parliament were withdrawn and the Department was requested to consider the rules. Now, new rules were tabled in Parliament during October 2007, and that is the rules that I will give a briefing on today. Now, in considering the rules of procedure for judicial review in terms of the Act, the following is, in our view, very important. There are different rules applicable in the Constitutional Court, the High Court, and Magistrates Court, which deals with applications and judicial review of proceedings in general. But it's clear from the provisions of the Act that the legislature intended a new procedure, and most probably a uniform procedure. to be applicable to FATA proceedings to the exclusion of all existing procedures and rules dealing with judicial review. Now, it's important that a simple, uniform, speedy and cost-effective procedure be developed to ensure access to the court and to limit costs for litigants. But it's also very important to take into account the nature of the various grounds of review in deciding what obligations should be placed on administrators. For instance, the one ground would be that the administrator does not have the necessary authority to act. It might also be that the feeling is that the right procedures were not followed, so there are many grounds of review. The provision should also not unduly burden the administrator. An example is Rule 53 of the High Court Rules, which deals inter alia with the review of administrative action. But it's also important to realize that the Rule 53 of the High Court Rules also deal with the review of criminal cases. That is, for instance, where a magistrate's court makes a finding and then the person is not happy with the conviction or the sentence, so that person then appeals to the High Court. Now, the administrator has to show cause why a decision should not be reviewed and must always, irrespective of the ground for the review, submit the record of the proceedings to the registrar of the High Court. This may be a very costly exercise. It can furthermore be argued that if the applicant relies, for example, on Section 62A1 of the Act, and that is that the administrator does not have the power to take the admin action as a ground for review, it should not be necessary to provide the applicant or the court, which will hear the matter, with a full record of the proceedings. The rule should strike a balance between the interests and rights of citizens to enforce their rights in terms of Section 33 of the Constitution on the one hand, but on the other hand, we must ensure an efficient administration. An unduly burden on the administration may result in the administration grinding to a halt. Many administrative decisions are taken daily which have an effect on citizens. For example, we can think about the social grant issue. The Constitutional Court rules are a good example of rules which ensure simple, speedy and cost-effective relief to parties. Now, I'd like to turn to the content of the rule. Now, the 6th of the High Court rule, that rule deals with applications in general in the High Court, and then Rules 11 and 12 of the Constitutional Court, which deals with applications in the Constitutional Court and urgent applications in the Constitutional Court, have been used as a basis for the drafting of the rules. The rules can be summarized as follows. Rule 1 deals with definitions, which indicate the meaning of words or phrases used in these rules, the aim of which is to make the rules easier to understand and to use. Rule 2 deals with the procedure for the institution of judicial review. Now, Rule 2 aims to ensure that the procedure prescribed in the rule and no other procedure must be followed in all applications for judicial review in terms of the Act. This will then mean that no more reliance can be placed on Rule 6 or Rule 53, for instance, of the High Court Rule. The aim is thus, as was already indicated, to prescribe a uniform procedure. In order to ensure that all possibilities have been covered, but without duplicating the existing rules of the court, provision has been made that certain High Court rules, namely the rules mentioned in Rule 10, which I will deal with later, may be used. And thirdly, that the rules of the court in which an application is brought may be supplemented or may supplement the prescribed rules should that be necessary. Now, Rule 3 of the rule deals with the notice of motion. The notice of motion is actually your application form. It deals with the notice of motion, which in essence, as I said, is the application for judicial review, and therefore certain information needs to be prescribed. Now, we prescribe the form being Form 1 that must be used for purposes of the application. The rule prescribes, for instance, that you need to indicate in the form what is the administrative action, or the administrative action, or so to speak, the decision which is to be reviewed, what the relief is that is to be claimed. And it expected from the person applying for judicial review to serve the application on the administrator and any other interested parties and file a copy with the clerk of the court, which then also includes the registrar. It also prescribes the documents which must accompany the application, namely an affidavit setting out the grounds for review, the facts and circumstances upon which the application is also based. The requirements of this rule are in line with the requirements for application in civil cases in our court, except for the requirements relating to aspects specifically required in the Act, and here we think about whether in the application you need to indicate whether or not internal remedies have been exhausted, and if not, why not, because the Act makes provision for that. But otherwise, it's just an application form and certain information that needs to be contained in and your normal affidavit. Now, from there directly, we have the response, so to speak, of the administrator and any other party. Now, in Rule 4, provision is made for the administrator or any other party to authorize the application. And a person who wishes to do so must notify the applicant of legal intention to oppose the application. And then secondly, once he or she has done that, an opposing affidavit must be delivered. And the purpose of this is to answer to the issues alleged in the application. This is, for instance, where the department, the administrator of the Department of Social Development, will say why and the reasons why the application for social grant has been denied and so forth. A person who wishes to oppose an application must serve both the notice of intention to oppose and the opposing affidavit on the applicant and any other interested party and false copy thereof with the clerk of the court. The requirement relating to service is the normal way of service as is indicated in the Magistrate Court rules and the High Court rules, meaning by a sheriff. The purpose of that is really to make sure that the party to whom the document is addressed has indeed received the document. Now the time frame based on working days has been set for the service of the document which must be served. Now the notice of intention to oppose must be done on Form 3 which has been prescribed. And once again, this step is in line with the rules providing for application. Now, in the event of any question of law, the question should be set out in the opposing affidavit. Now, Rule 5 of the rules deals with a reply affidavit. So you've already got your application, then you're given the administrator or any other party the opportunity to answer to the allegations or the issues raised in the application. Now you're actually then giving another, so to speak, right to the applicant, and that is to reply to the issues raised by the respondent, which in this case will be the administrator, in the opposing affidavit. The applicant must also serve the replying affidavit on the administrator and any other interested party and file a copy with the clerk of the court. And then the applicant must reply within a prescribed period. Now, then the next rule is Rule 6, and that is the rule facilitating applications for review and other applications. Now, this Rule 6 cases for a variety of aspects. Firstly, it authorizes the court to do the following. The court may allow the filing of further affidavits, because we have now only two affidavits. The one is with the application, and the second one is the opposing affidavit. The court may also, after hearing an application, make no order, but they allow the applicant to renew the application. The court may also, if it cannot decide the matter on affidavit, dismiss the application or direct that oral evidence be heard or refer the matter for trial. The court may also strike from any affidavit any matter which is scandalous, vexatious, or irrelevant. And then lastly, the court may also consolidate actions. It also provides for the following aspects: the joining of persons as applicants, respondents, and amicus curiae, the friend of the court. If I can just explain that the meaning of amicus curiae, it refers to a person that is an outsider who has an interest in a matter before the court, but whose interest is not represented by the parties. Then secondly, it also provides for the bringing of a counter application, which means that when an action is brought against the person that is now the administrator, and he or she has any kind of cross action against the person who brought the action, meaning the applicant, then the person against whom the action is brought may impede or her response to the claim of the applicant may resolve her claim. Then also what is important is that the procedure provides for interlocutory and other incidental applications that may be brought. Now, an interlocutory order is an order granted by the court at an intermediate stage in the course of litigation, settling or giving directions in regard to some preliminary or procedural question which has been arisen in the dispute between the parties. And then we thought it in also to make provision for ex parte applications. It might not necessarily be required, but we want to make sure that should there be an instance where an ex parte application needs to be brought, that provision is made for that. And for this reason also a form has been prescribed, namely form 2 attached to the rule. Now, Rule 7 deals with urgent applications. We think it's also important that taking the nature of the decisions normally taken, we need to have a rule in place which deals with urgent applications. Now, we've made provision for urgent applications in line with Rule 12 of the Constitution or the Court Rules. We're also aware of the fact that Rule 6 of the High Court Rules also provides for urgent applications, but we deem it fit rather to follow the procedure in Rule 12 of the Constitutional Court Rules. Now, in terms of Rule 7, the presiding officer may, should the circumstances then justify departure of the rule, dispense with the forms and services provided for in this rule and give directions for the handling of the matter. Then Rule 8 of the rules deals with applications for temporary relief. Now, this is directly related to Section 8 of the Act, which provides for an application for temporary relief, and therefore procedure has been developed, similar to an application for judicial review. One example being of an application for temporary relief is for, of course, an application for an interdict. Now, Rule 9 of the rules deals with setting matters down for hearing. Provision has been made for the setting down of the matter by the applicant and the respondent to ensure that the finalization of the matter is not delayed by any party. The applicant or the respondent, depending on the circumstances, may request the clerk of the court in writing to allocate the date for the hearing of the matter. In both instances, written notice of the date allocated must be given to all other parties. Then, what you will see in Rule 10 of the rules, there is a general rule, and that rule lists a number of High Court rules which will apply when an application is brought, irrespective of the court in which an application is brought. I can just mention, the reason for this is, I think the experience has shown also that the High Court rules are very simple and it's easy to follow, and that is why we thought that we can incorporate by means of reference some of the High Court rules to facilitate an application for judicial review. Whereas the High Court rules, we deem them to be very easy and simplistic. We also know that the magistrate's court rules are not always so user-friendly, and it's very difficult to apply. Now, the listed High Court rules are proved to be practical and simple, as I said, and there's no need to deviate from these rules. The rules listed related inter alia to service, power of attorney, change and representation of parties, non-compliance with rules, discovery and inspection of documents, And if, for instance, an application is brought in a magistrate's court and there's a request that the time period provided for in Rule 4, please rule back to extend, then Rule 27 of the High Court rules will apply, which will then mean, in first instance, that the rules that we specifically provide for will apply. But if there's any reason why you need to apply other rules, you first go to Rule 10 and see whether in that list there's not a High Court rule that will apply. And if there's still something missing which you want to do in terms of Rule 2, you will see when you use the Magistrate Court rules or the High Court rules the High Court rules or then the Constitutional Court rules, as the case may be. Then Rule 11 is the court fees, and 812 is the short cycle, which is the practice to provide for a short cycle for rules or regulations to facilitate reference. And we deemed it advisable then to add a Rule 9 which deals with a commencement provision, because of the fact that in the absence thereof, the rules will come into operation on the date of publication thereof, which in this case is also not legally possible in view of the provisions of the Rules for the Court of Law Act, which requires that rules must be published 30 days before the commencement thereof. And then we will see also forms have been designed, namely three, the one I've already mentioned, which is the notice of motion, and that must be used when you apply for judicial review. Then, and also when you lodge an application for temporary leave. The second form is the one to be used in the case of an ex parte application, and then the third form is the notice of intention to oppose. Now, in conclusion, the rules basically provide for the following. An application for judicial review by means of a notice of motion in the prescribed form and an accompanying affidavit which must be delivered to the party. Secondly, the respondent may then oppose the application and he or she must do so by delivering of an opposing affidavit. Then the applicant may in turn reply to the opposing party by delivery of a replying affidavit. Then provision has been made for rules facilitating the application of for judicial review. Urgent applications may be brought. Applications for temporary relief in line with Section 8 of the Act is possible. Then the setting down of the matter for hearing has been regulated. Then Rule 10, which is then the listed High Court rules, which may be used to supplement the rules if necessary. And then provision has been made for court fees in the amount of 50 rand, irrespective of the court in which the application is brought. I think the approach, if I can summarize, the approach followed in drafting this rule is to say, before you decide to bring an application for judicial review, you must, by means of the Access to Information Act, try to get records, documents, or whatever you need. Then, insofar if you need reasons, then you actually try through the Act, meaning the culture, to get the reasons. And only when you've done that, when you're ready and you've decided really the correct procedure has not been followed, or the person didn't have proper authority to act or to decide on an application, then you revert to an application, and that's when the rules kick in. Thank you.
Thank you. Just on a practical level, just tell me if I've got it correctly. If I'm instituting a normal civil case, okay, then I would do it either in the Magistrate Court, the High Court, not the Constitutional Court, in terms of those rules, existing rules as they stand. If I bring an action or application for judicial review, these rules would then supersede the existing Magistrates Court, High Court, and Constitutional Court rules. Except insofar as things like intersection and timeline and stuff, then we would revert back to the rules of the court in which you are bringing your action. First question is, do we think these rules would actually enhance easier access to justice? Because they seem, in my view, to be very similar to existing rules that are applicable in our court already. I mean, the notice of motion looks very much like a notice of motion. Does it go far enough in providing easy access? And then you also recall that when we saw the room in 2001, there were concerns that it was too onerous on administrators, whether those concerns were met. And then up in the office, what? Dr. Delaporte?
So maybe I should have raised the issue at the beginning, but we clearly see there's a huge dispute between the department and the rules board, and we need an explanation about that. Yeah. And then just what rules are being applied at the moment? Are there in applications that are being done at the moment? Are they being done in terms of the Rule 53 procedures of the Supreme Court? So I just kind of get my mind around that. But we'll have to deal with that whole issue. Thank you.
Look, maybe just while we're on that point, just for the other members, members will note that there's been a letter which has been sent to this committee from the Rules Board. In the letter, the Rules Board says that the rules which are before us are departmental rules and that the Rules Board has a set of different rules for Pratchard. Now, to me, it seems like the crisp issue is whose responsibility is it to make the rules? Is it the Rules Board or is it the department, or more specifically the ministry? So if I could hear the department on that issue. And then yeah, I'll come to a way of how we take the matter forward, I think. But let's hear them out on that first.
Yes, the I haven't got this here, but the present Supreme Court rules make provision that the applicant will request the record of proceedings and reasons for coming to a particular finding. This, of course, assists in an applicant to precisely make a delimitation of exactly the points and issues. I see these rules do not make provision if I read correctly for asking from the, what you call it, the administrator, the record and the reasons.
Chair, you know, we'll respond to the general questions as far as the rules are concerned, and I will try to respond as far as the letter is concerned.
Oh, sorry, I'll start with the easier question. The one on the comment of the then Portfolio Committee back in 2001. The rules that were then before the committee provided that your notice of motion will start to say that the respondent must show cause why the relief required or claimed in the notice of motion should not be allowed. And bringing the whole issue of taking the onus, putting the onus on the administrator, which in our view is problematic and unfortunately in the committee's view as well. The second aspect was that the rules also provided that immediately with the reasons, because the administrator must show cause why the relief should not be allowed, and then secondly, immediately all the reasons for the decision had to be given, and then thirdly, immediately the whole record of the proceedings had been provided. Now, as far as my memory is concerned, that was more or less the major concerns of the then Portfolio Committee as far as the rules are concerned. Now, the issue of an application, how an application for judicial review is presently dealt with, is the following. That there was a court case, I think it's the Jockey Court case, that in which the court indicated any applicant may, if he or she wants to apply for the judicial review of an act in action, may either follow Rule 6 of the High Court rule, which is very simplistic and which also is similar to the rules that we've drafted, that first part. It's where you have an application, you have an opposing application, you have a replying, so to speak, a reply and a replying affidavit. So so that you can either use that, and if you need further information, my understanding is then you make use of the other sub-provisions of Rule 6, where you as the interlocutory application then apply for further particulars and so forth. Then also what is happening, they can also use Rule 53 of the High Court Rule, meaning that that is the review, they call it the review rule, which is similar to then, as I said, the rules that were tabled in 2002, where you have the application and immediately the respondent must show cause why the relief claim should not be given, reasons must be given, and then thirdly, the third thing is that the whole record should be submitted. So the applicant then is entitled now to choose between Rule 6 and Rule 53, which in our view, in terms of the reading of the Act, is not what's supposed to happen. There must be one rule and a uniform rule. But also presently, as the one section in the Act reads, is until Parliament has approved rules, the Pacha rules, the applications are heard in the High Court rules. So those are the two rules that apparently is being used now. Then, the first one, whether it's really enhancing access, I think that from our side, the department is of the view that it does enhance access. As I said, our approach has been that you need to use the Access to Information Act to get the information, and then you must make the decision whether you want to institute the review. But yet, if in the process of that review you want further information, be provided for that either by directly providing for that or through the incorporation of the High Court rules listed in Rule 10. And then thirdly, it can also the rules here can also be supplemented by the Magistrates Court, the High Court rules in that. Insofar as
How exactly do the proposed rules here enhance access to justice as compared to the rule that currently exists? Those of us who are non-lawyers in this committee, can you explain to us simply how? Just say it to me. When I ask this question, I also think this Act is very significant. It's part of advancing and transforming the country. It's a wonderful piece of legislation, actually. It is rare in the developing world, but we also have to be modest about what we can achieve. But as I understand, I was not in this committee then, necessarily, and very happy, let me add. But the truth is that I was aware of this piece, as most of us who were not in this committee were aware. It's a wonderful idea in the Constitution, and it's crucial to democracy and the right of citizens for access to the state and the state making correct decisions. So in that context, it's not clear to me. Maybe it's because I don't know the issues, but unfortunately I'm the chair of this committee, and the co-chair in this case, and ultimately there are others here who might not also be lawyers. So can you explain to us how, simply, this set of rules is in advance of what currently exists? You see, if I listen to what the chair is saying here, she seems to suggest, maybe I'm misinterpreting you, that the current rules don't necessarily foster access to justice in the way they should. And therefore, she's hoping that this is setting a precedent. So how? It may be very significant. It may 10 years from now be used, the principles of it, as a basis to do all the rules of our system again.
I think I will best respond to the question by saying we'll refer to the magistrate. I think if you look at the process that we have here in the rules for an application for judicial review, you will see that although there is, I think it's Rule 55 of the Magistrates Court Rules, it really doesn't tell you exactly what to do, when to do that. It does not really facilitate the whole process. Whereas this, the inverted rule, it's so direct. You say what you want, you say why you are not happy with the decision, and then from there you just give the other party the opportunity to respond to that. I will say that it's true that if you look at the proposed rule, there's not much difference, if any, insofar as Rule 6 is concerned, because Rule 6, as I said, is more or less in line with what we propose here. But then if you look at Rule 53, it's also almost a lengthy process, although the concerns there is more on the onerous obligation on the administrator. But for me, is merely this is an improvement of the magistrate's court rules. It really clearly tells you what it is, what you need, etc. And then so far as access is concerned, I think if you can look at the court fees, it's 50 rand, I think it's the same as the magistrate's court rules now. So I think in that sense also, it's very easy. And as I said, the practitioners that we've spoken to, is they're quite comfortable with Rule 6 of the High Court rules. So you can't really make it easier than that. And by prescribing certain forms as well, we also try really to assist the applicants in doing so. But I think what is important to know as well, that if you look at the Fajr Act, it's not a decision and directly there to the court. There's an intermediate step as well. The Act requires, before you go to court, you must first of all exhaust your internal revenues. Which will then, for instance, mean, let me take maybe a stupid example, but to say is, if you try to get a record from an administrator or a letter, or you try to get reasons from the administrator, and that administrator fails to provide you with that, you're not going to jump immediately to the court. You will say, I'm going to go to the minister responsible for that, that would then constitute the internal remedy. And that's why in the Act it says that you're actually not allowed to go to the court. You must first exhaust that. And only if that hasn't been exhausted, or if under exceptional circumstances, the court has allowed you not to take part in that process, or to use that process, then you are allowed to use that. So I think for me, if you look at that, you will normally first try through the lens of the minister or the DG or whatever. Now it's true that a lot of people will say that if you look at the procedures or acts, you don't normally have a prescribed process where you say, if you're not happy, you go to the minister. But if you look at how the government and state administration functions, normally that is the route that you follow. And I'm sure that if you go to the minister, notwithstanding your request for the information or the reasons, you're not being given that, then surely that will the court will accept that as utilizing your internal remedy, although in the maybe the Act regulating the application for social grant, there's not a prescribed procedure. So that is how we to make it uniform and then to say, really, we know the magistrate law court rules, especially insofar as applications are concerned, they are not well. And on the other hand, Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, we feel that if you look at Rule 11 of the Constitutional Court rules, it's really very, very easy, just that, and we prescribe form. I'm sorry, that is how far I can take it.
Act doesn't say anything about the role of Parliament, role of MPC. Now, of course, if the civil servants don't respond, or they take an action that you want for the judicial review, then surely your first port of call is a member of Parliament. You know, getting to the minister is very difficult. I mean, the minister, there's nothing in the Act about that. Sorry? And secondly, can a court act? I'm sorry to belabor this thing, but this is really something that strikes the heart of our democracy. Right? The other thing I want to ask you is, can a court say, you have applied, but we're not prepared to consider your application in this issue, a court process, because you've not exhausted your remedy, your internal remedy. You haven't gone to MP, you haven't gone to your civil servant, DG, you haven't gone to the minister. Can I say, you know, first do those things?
I just wanted to get a copy of the Act with me, section 678 something. The thing is that in the Act itself, it does say that you must first of all exhaust your internal remedies. Here, let me just give. No court shall review an act in action in terms of this Act unless any internal remedy provided for in any other law has first been exhausted. Meaning to say, if for instance the Social Grant Act, I don't know what is the correct title, say, if you're not happy with the decision of the administrator, then first of all you have a right of review or appeal or what they call it to the Minister of Social Development. Then it will mean the court will reject it. But what I'm suggesting is to say, even in the absence of a provision like that, is one should try to foster this initiative, whatever, to say if before you go to civil proceedings, go maybe to your MP, although it's not written, but the court will not reject it on the fact that you haven't gone to your member of parliament or the minister if it's not a prescribed. But we thought we know normally that is another way of dealing with that. But so to speak, your review procedure in the context of this section relating to the exhaustion of your internal remedies is the court is the last resort.
Thanks, Mr.
Rutland.
May I be on the other issues?
There are really three issues as far as the letter is concerned. Firstly, the question whether the rules should apply to the Constitutional Court or not. And then secondly, it deals with the procedure, the way in which applications are brought. That's the second difference, if I might call it that. And then the third point is who makes the rules. Now, as far as the first one is concerned, it's a fairly technical argument. We're saying that the rules should also apply to the Constitutional Court, because FAJA defines court to include the Constitutional Court. And our argument is, therefore, that the rules should also apply to the Constitutional Court. And as Ina has indicated, we have borrowed quite a lot from the rules of the Constitutional Court in formulating these rules. The other argument is that it does not apply to the Constitutional Court because the Chief Justice make the rules of the Constitutional Court in terms of the Complementary Act. Now, our argument is that the FAJA Act is a later act, and therefore it does apply, and it does make it possible for us to make rules also for the Constitutional Court. And obviously the argument is that for uniformity's sake, so that the same rules, when it comes to FAJA, the same rules apply in all our court structures.
Chief Justice, they're saying the Chief Justice is doing that, does he have a view of the Constitutional Court?
I don't think we did not consult with the Chief Justice. This is really a legal point and a technical point. But as far as I know, it was not discussed with the Chief Justice, not by the department. I don't know whether it was done by the Rules Board, but not from our side. So then the second issue relates to the procedure that I indicated. Now, the rules that were submitted to the to Parliament in 2001, Tina indicated that the Portfolio Committee at that stage felt that the procedures were not streamlined, were not appropriate or desirable, and were too onerous on administrators. Now, as far as I can remember, the rules that were submitted recently by the Rules Board basically contain the same provision. What it provides for is that if there's an application, in terms of those rules, the administrator then had to provide a list of all the documents relating to the issue under discussion, and if there's a record of proceedings, also a copy of the record of proceedings. Only thereafter then can the applicant then once again ask for access to those documents, and then once he's done that, then he can amend his application, his original application. The argument in 2001 was that is a very lengthy process. Number one, it's not streamlined, it's not appropriate, and it places too heavy a burden on administrators. and the rules that you have before you now is plain and simple, application, response, and a further response. So we give the applicant has the opportunity to once again respond on the affidavit of the administrator. In any event, as Ina has indicated, there are a number of other acts dealing with this issue. Before, our view is that before an applicant approaches by way of application a court, he should use other acts, other pieces of legislation to get the necessary information that he requires. But in any event further, we also make the provisions of some of the High Court rules applicable to these rules. For example, that the applicant can ask for discovery of documents at one or other stage during the proceedings. So we thought that the rules that we have submitted to you are to this committee and to Parliament, that these rules are much more streamlined and much quicker to deal with these type of issues. The third point is the question of who makes the rules. In terms of Fajr, rules are made by the Rules Board in terms of the Rules Board Act, and it must be approved by Parliament. In terms of the Rules Board Act, the Minister, rules are submitted by the Rules Board to the Minister, and the Minister approves the rules. So that is why you will also find that the heading of the notice that you submitted or tabled reads that the Minister for Justice has approved the rules after considering proposals made by the Rules Board. So the argument is that it is in fact the Minister that makes the rules, and these rules must be approved by Parliament. There is, if I understand it correctly, a different view on the part of the Rules Board.
Just for the sake of clarity, so what the Department is saying is that Section 2 of the Rules, the Rules Board for Courts of Law Act says that they may make, amend, or repeal rules subject to the approval of the Minister. Okay. And you said that that trumps the Section, what is it, Section 7 or Section 10 of the Bar Charter?
Well, in the sense that they make the rules in terms of the Rules Board Act. Although this gives them the authority to make the rules, they do so in terms of the Rules Board Act. And in terms of the Rules Board Act, the rules are approved by the Minister for Justice.
Section 7 of Parliament doesn't say that they make the rules in terms of the Rules Board Act. I mean, what was the intention of the Minister today?
Well, he
said, take it, that they don't say to themselves, but that's the way it's done always.
Yeah. Because they've established an establishment in terms of a particular act.
Therefore, they act in terms of that act. Yeah.
That act.
Okay, so that's clear.
And just another question. I mean, if the Rules Board is a creature of statute, then surely it can only do what it is entitled to do in its enabling legislation, or not?
No, correct. That is its founding legislation. And that's where the powers come from. Although the Fajr says that they make the rules, they do so in terms of their founding legislation.
Okay, so in my view, and correct me if I'm wrong, Mr. Rubin, but it's a matter of legal opinion differing.
Yes.
And I can't see how we're going to reach consensus between the Department and the Rules Board, because they have their opinion and you have yours. My suggestion to the committee,
So one is, interestingly, Laurie, I don't know, is allowed to speak in his meeting. The research is allowed to speak. In his meeting. He actually picks up a question I'm picking up, which is, can I just ask, two issues. One is the question she asked, which is what I've got here as well. If, let's say now, what does the law say? If the minister needs Parliament's approval for, I'm just in the procedure, they don't get upset now. Just for clarity's sake, right? And if you've got problems, ask the Julie House why they put me here, but anyway. Now the problem is, you can see I'm never going to live this down there. I'll need therapy for the next 10 years, Steve is probably going to say. But the point is, what is Parliament's power? Can we say,
in terms of legislation that no, we don't agree with the minister. If that's the case, you know, it's approved by Parliament. So is it, am I understanding this correct? We can actually agree. Not that I'm saying we should. I'm merely raising the question. We can agree with the rules board rather than the minister. And the minister has no recourse to Parliament ultimately sovereign, right? Point one. Point two is, you know, in the way you say it sweepingly, yeah, the question only arises to somebody like me. You say, well, it's the minister that makes the rules. In that case, why are the rules for? Why does the department just do it? In case you've done it in this case, right? So presumably, although the minister has ultimate power to make the rules, they have to take into account very strongly and strenuously, is there such a word, what the rules board says. You see, I have a problem. I'll be upfront about this thing because the problem occurred many years later. When I was chairing the local government committee, there's an independent demarcation board. But the demarcation bill that was before us says that what the demarcation board does, it applies these 10-12 criteria, and we expanded the criteria. We also provided for more community consultation and all that. And then the issue arose that the minister can override a decision of the demarcation board. To which we said to the constitutional experts in the department and parliament, is that correct? There's an independent demarcation board in parliament, the constitution, right? It is allowed here to apply the criteria. And then the minister can say, no, you apply your mind, but hey, I don't agree with it. Now we actually had the practical experience 2 years ago. This is something Parliament needs to apply itself to. I'm not saying we can address this now, community. It's the same sort of thing. You know, I don't know what the relationship is. I mean, if the minister can just make the rules, and why have a rules for? Two questions, and the rest don't respond to it. It's too complex. You're going to say something, I'm going to reply, and you're going to reply. Let's leave the one about the demarcation board out. But that's the thing that others might want to think about. The powers of a minister to override and a board that's using objective support. Is that they probably go to the court and say they haven't applied because of the criteria of demarcation bill correctly.
See, as far as Parliament's role is concerned, it's really very much a constitutional issue. What is the role of Parliament? The Act says very clearly that Parliament approves the rules. If Parliament does not approve, then there are no rules. And I remember reading about this some time ago, and I will look at it again, because quite clearly you then have a veto power. If the rules are submitted and you do not approve, then you do not approve, and as I say, there's no rules. And to my mind, the same applies as far as the rules board is concerned. Although it says the rules board make the rules or amend rules, it is still subject to the approval of the minister. And then, therefore, the minister has also a power and a role to play, exactly the same as the role of Parliament. And the rules board then, to my mind, is exactly the same as the South African Law Reform Commission, for example. They make recommendations, although the Act says make the rules, it is still subject to the approval of the minister. And therefore, if the minister can just then disapprove, and then there are no rules. Possibly the way in which one should deal with this is that one should try to get agreement on the rules between the minister and the rules board to refer it back. But in this case, if I understand correctly and remember correctly, these rules come from 2001. They were referred back, and the same rules were submitted, and therefore the minister then decided to. And it was in a letter.
I don't want to, but there's so many questions that arise from what you're saying, and it isn't time to discuss it. And the members are getting fed up with my questions. You're a majority, you can just shut up, okay? Say it in a nice way, itself, what? You know, but you can say, look, Comrade Chair, you know, we can't say Comrade Chair, Mr. Chairperson, Co-Chairperson, or whatever. Can you discuss the outside of the meeting? I'm quite happy to do it, but I want to alert the ANC to the issues that arise here. One is, sorry? Oh, you're not. One is, sorry. Oh, okay, you can confirm. I just don't accept that there's an equation between the powers of the minister and the rules board and the power of parliament and the minister. The minister is one individual.
And if the rules board and the minister don't agree, I think there's a greater need to arrive at synergy. I don't know if he finds the time and energy. And I would ask you to give us a full report on what you've done, you know, as a department on behalf of the minister, in conferring with the rules board to arrive at consensus. Point two, I don't understand. The same issue arises for the rules board. If Parliament said to the rules board, hey, it's too onerous, it's 2,000, why are they bringing back the same rules? It's like a disrespect for Parliament. So it applies equally to the executive as it applies to the rules board. Thirdly, you see the difference between the minister and the rules board. We are representatives in serious and in the constitution of the people of this country. Often we don't seem to realize that. And often we don't fulfill the obligations that the constitution imposes on us deriving therefrom. But the fact is that, you know, I just don't buy that, you know. The final point I want to make is, you see, John, I asked the two subjects of the question was, you're saying, if we say no to the minister's rules, we can just veto it. But presumably we don't have the right to accept the rules of the rules board, because then Parliament is shaping the rules. So it's impasse. In other words, unlike legislation, where what we can literally do is rewrite the rules, we've written the rules, you know, like the Municipal Structures Act is got at the bottom there, as introduced by the Portfolio Committee, because the amendments were, you know, so long. And your own votes. I think that CRC vote was completely written by this committee. Yeah? So in cases of bills, we are able to change completely. But in the case of rules and regulations, it's an executive process that we're doing. It's subordinate legislation. And there are limits. We can veto it, we can say no to it, but we can't change it. So in actual fact, it's an academic question to look at the rules for the rules. I actually thought we were going to make a choice ultimately, combine the two, or whatever. Actually, you can then withdraw the rules altogether. If we decide to accept half of the rules for stuff and half of your stuff, then you're going to say, no, the minister's withdrawing. Is that correct, yeah? Yeah, I'm just dealing with processes. Okay, I don't know if I see Wyndham here, but he's experienced. We're just raising, well, this is my friend there. We're just raising theoretical questions. Okay, I mean, we're not saying that, okay. Well, I can't subscribe to you. I don't know what the average reader of your newspaper would be interested in this cigar, quite frankly. But if you've got nothing better to write about, please get it right. We are raising questions. We're not taking any decisions. Okay.
Let me
tell you.
No, Mr.
Clark,
I think I have a question.
I think you can Mr. Lock chair in some issues that I was going to raise. My concern is long term. Possible litigation on this impost. If you look at the letters that the rules board has written, and clearly I'm not debating the merits of what rules you're going to follow, but the process, they are already alleging that they've been treated in a humiliating way, and they say inconsistent with the law. Now that's their legal view, you differ. But a litigant can pick this up and attach it to his papers and contest the whole rules at the last day. An unhappy litigant is unhappy with Tadger and the rule. He takes this and it gives him, because you've got two legal opinions now. The department's got a view and the rules board has got a view. And they are saying it's inconsistent with the law. They might be wrong, they might be right. So we do sit with the impost, so maybe we need to get a parliamentary legal opinion on it. Or some opinion. I'm not, you know, that's just what I'm saying.
That's exactly the point, Mr. Swart, that I think that we need to deal with. And I'd like to hear the committee on this. My personal view is there's a deadlock, and we need to get past this deadlock. Now, you'll see in the last letter of the judges, the last sentence of the judge's letter, she writes that they're not prepared to give us any input in the deliberations on these rules. But they've written to us, and it's now our responsibility. My suggestion to the committee would be that we consider forming a multi-party subcommittee, that we contact Judge Nkabeni again, ask her if they would be prepared to sit down with us so that we hear them out, that the same subcommittee then go back to the Department of Justice and
if we then, if that subcommittee then feels that we need to get a legal opinion from, albeit the parliamentary law advisors or even an outside third opinion, that we do so, and that subcommittee then reports back to this committee. Practically, I don't know how else we're going to deal with it. But I'd like to hear the committee on that.
I entirely agree with the co-chair. I don't think at this stage it seems necessary to go and get a legal opinion. The spirit in which this committee is operating is to try to get consensus. And only one slight thing, co-chair, is you might want to think about, and members of, instead of us meeting the... firstly, I find it untenable. I don't know, maybe this is the way judges operate, in which case, maybe the norm, but hopefully with a transformative agenda, these things will change. We'll then get the advocates refuse to have their records checked. I mean, we're not going to that. The fact is, it's wrong, I think. We should watch carefully since we have a meeting here. It strikes me as curious, let's put it that way, that the judge makes a representation to us, sends us weighty documentation, and then says, no, we don't want to make any further submission. How is Parliament going to judge the value of what the rules board is saying, unless, like with the department, to be fair, we are able to exchange with them and engage with them? You see, that text may raise a thousand different questions. And how are we going to get clarity on this? So, firstly, I think it's not acceptable, it's not tenable to do, not remember the rules, but it just strikes me as curious, okay? So, I think what we ask the chair to do is to contact Judge Kabine and see whether she will delegate somebody to come, or more than one, she can make herself available. And we do it within the next 2 weeks. But we have the department at the same meeting, and then we report back to the portfolio committee. I think there might be slight sensitivity, so I don't think we should, we can meet in an afternoon, we can check. Maybe if I can just amplify what you're saying, committee, maybe one from the ACCP, one from the GA, and two or three from the ANC. But if they want to bring more members, they can. It's no problem. Okay, whoever wants to come from this committee, right? Everybody wants to come, it's fine. We'll meet in the afternoon, where it suits all of us, and then we'll report back to the committee. It'll be a closed subcommittee meeting. We've done that 100 times in local government. It's done in terms of the rules of parliament, and we cannot take any decision. We will report back, and if need be, the judge will have to come before the whole committee or a representative of her. But I think we should have both together so we hear both sides. Let's do it to a subcommittee and report back to the committee. I don't see a problem in arriving at some consensus before we go for... The legal opinion will only arrive if there's a deadlock.
Can we just crystallize the issues that are the difference?
Yeah.
Because we're sitting with two different laws, and maybe we can just get to sense of what are the two differing issues. And then one can get... Well, firstly, I presume, we're presuming that the department and the rules board cannot agree. Is that a correct presumption? Firstly, we need to interrogate that quickly. Do we, because we've now taken it upon ourselves to then resolve this issue. Secondly, then, to crystallize the differences, and then one can enter a process of trying to find the way forward. And I fully agree, only at a later stage then, that to determine the impact. Thank you.
Yeah, before I give Dion a chance to respond, you'll see there's a letter in that the minister wrote to the rules board saying that if they want to take the matter further to address it to this committee. So I think that's where they are, that's what you're seeing.
No, that's the point. And then the two issues really relate to the Constitutional Court, whether the rules should apply to the Constitutional Court or not, and then the procedure to be followed. And let's just mention that I understand that the rules that were submitted in 2001, they have been adapted to some extent. They're not the same rules that were submitted in 2001, the rules that were submitted now. So those are really the two issues, whether it applies to the Constitutional Court or not, and then secondly, the procedure that needs to be followed. Now, you're saying that our procedure is a more streamlined and very easy procedure.
This committee can deal with this, but we need to get clarity also on one aspect, and that is these rules, for instance, Well, that goes for any submission to Parliament. If rules are submitted to Parliament, can Parliament amend the rules before adopting them? Can the minister amend before putting his signature to it?
That's also, there's also, I think, a difference of opinion. In my mind, what the committee would do was would be to make suggestions to the minister on how the rules should be changed. And if the minister agrees with that, then obviously the minister will be quite happy. And I think then once the committee can then continue to deal with the rules.
Which re-emphasizes the point that if we could get consensus on this, it would obviously be the best way forward. Could I then just hear the committee out whether I then have a mandate to speak to Judge Nkabindi on behalf of the committee?
What role does the Chief Justice play?
Yeah,
we obviously, I think he needs the input on the issue of the Constitution.
Okay.
From what I recall, I think the Rules Board have already under correction, but that the Rules Board would have consulted the Chief Justice. So therefore, all the more reason to hear from the Rules Board.
The procedure also should be. Yeah, I think we should ask for a report on what you have done to get them. But anyway, now, I think also is. Isn't it like much easier if you report it to us? Maybe it's not the norm. Again, I don't understand why judges are. I understand the separation of powers, but then you're the executive of the parliament. I don't know why the department wouldn't contact the Chief Justice and say, excuse me, do you agree with the rules of order? Do you agree with us? And then if the Chief Justice says, no, I agree with you anyway, it's quite easy. The rules board is speaking about the Chief Justice and the Constitutional Court itself is saying, we don't really think what the rules board is saying. It'll help us, because then it is the Chief Justice starting with the department. But there's a second issue within which we have to locate the things. We shouldn't be too technical about this, you know. I can understand. I think underlying what some of us are saying, you see, we must be clear that regrettably the state is weak. And regrettably the state does not do enough. Ask any active constituency MP the number of times we as members of parliament find civil servants inaccessible. So therefore, this right that the citizen has got is a very important right in a national democratic transformation, to use our jargon. And we as parliament are almost compelled to ensure that the rules are done in a way that's consistent with what is intended by those who drafted the Constitution. Now, that has to be balanced against the recognition that we are a developing democracy. That precisely because the state is weak, on the one hand you want this right, but on the other hand you cannot make it onerous. I'll give you one example. In 1995, I approached the then Minister of Correctional Services around the way they were dealing with, in Peter Maritzburg, decisions about parole. And they're not even called this person. They sit in the corridor at the time. The parole board meets, they look at the information on a piece of paper, and then they call the person in and say, no, no parole for you. When I found out that they existed in the interim constitutional equivalent of this provision, I then, you know, wrote to the minister, I think it was in Manila at the time, no response to this. You're right again, the fact that he has lost. Finally, I went to the chairperson, Carl Rios at the time, and told him, you know what? Actually, I want to use this provision in the constitution and so on. Within 48 hours, I got a meeting. The minister was there, but his spokesperson phoned me and said, no, don't do this. You know, if you do this, you will win, and the whole system of correctional services will explode. Because what you are asking for, we're going to go to court. Because they're not responding to say every person who's turned down for parole must be given in writing a full and comprehensive explanation. In theory, that is correct in the Constitution. But in practice, John, it would clog the entire correctional services department down. As it is, they are crumbling in the face of their challenges. So similarly, I think we need to balance easy access to justice and the importance of this right with the recognition of where we are in the unfolding transformation. We are not clear. But we're not, Burundi or Bangladesh either. You know? And we've got to strike a balance. So why is it important to some of us? And we're not naive populists. I mean, you know, citizens can abuse this right as well. But on the other hand, we need to find the balance. Even health facilities in the street use is under pressure also from these sorts of things. So in short, I'm making a long speech, but I'm trying to communicate why we are engaging in the way we are. I'm communicating the politics of the majority party. We feel, yes, the right is important, but we also agree. The state. Can I just ask you a question, John? Is there any developing society that has the equivalent of this thing to the extent and scope and nature we have? Countries like India, Brazil, do they have something like this? Isn't this a very advanced piece of legislation? It's probably more equivalent to advanced industrialized countries. It's probably more advanced than Sweden. How is it Sweden, by the way? Because it's generally understood as one of the most open, transparent democracies. It's not true. I mean, it's very advanced. Maybe a bit too advanced for our country. I mean, it's an ideal we're striving towards. It's not something we can implement fully now. So that I'm recognizing the problem. But on the other hand, we can do a bit more for the citizen too.
I think that's why we're trying to make the rules as simple as possible.
But without prejudicing
absolutely.
The citizen's right, and without imposing on the state. So we're trying to tell you we have a balance for the change. That's what it's. Because they're probably thinking, the way we're asking questions, hey, these people are thinking me like, you know.
Really, that is...
The thing is weak, ideologically.
That's really the, I think, the main, the crux of the difference between the rules of the department and that of the rules board. The idea has always been to try to make it as simple and as quickly as possible without placing an excessive burden on the state, while still retaining all the provisions in the federal rules for, as I said, for discovery and so forth. And also bearing in mind that we have the promotion of access to information, in terms of which anyone with an interest can ask for information and copies of documentation. So that has been our view. And that has been the view of since 2001. And I must just say too that since 2001 there were many meetings between the rules board, a member of the rules board, and officials from the department, as well as the executive. Many meetings where these rules were discussed. And I think that's why eventually we had to take the decision to bring the rules to Parliament, so that we can process. Because it's important to get the rules, because as Nina said to you, the rules, you can only make use of the magistrate's court once the rules have been finalized. And that also ensures access to justice once that is done.
And yeah, see, mechanically, the way out would be for us to say, recognizing where we are in an unfolding transformation, it means really long way. So on. You know, the mechanical way out is to say, okay, we accept rules for now that maybe are not so onerous, but 10 years from now, we wait in the other direction of, you know, putting pressure on the civil service to actually give information in the earlier phase. The balance will change, right? But there's no such thing. You can't make the rules that these rules will not change in 10 years, and it's beautiful to say that. The other thing I want to say to friends here, something with Bulgari we need to look at. You see those reports to Parliament? Actually, they're quite meaningless at one level. Without these reports, they have no legal meaning. And then, you know, the next chairperson changes next week and utility members move around, and people forget the earlier reports. If you look, for example, at the Property Rights Act at the moment, we wrote such a lengthy report. We even set out the program and I get cheap. I'm not chair anymore. I get phoned all the time. And what we had intended, what Mr. Fadati is doing, is a big difference. But the meaning of some of those clauses actually to be found in our report to Parliament, which nobody reads. You know, so I was thinking what we can do, a specific issue, is where we feel that the rules of the rules board are good, but they are just premature, given the phase we're in. We can say that these department rules are fine for now, but 5 years from now they lapse and it should be reviewed. I don't know. We write it without a board in Parliament, or things like that we can think about. I'm thinking of all options. Okay? But I really feel like stop. I'll be able to do that. Sorry.
Right, so well, a mandate, do you think, for the subsidy? Commissioner, I agree with the recommendation that we should have the other committee. Because really, one, I was asking myself, 2001, when this was sent back to the department, what was wrong? Perhaps we can even have those rules that were not agreed upon 2001 and see what the difference is right now, because we also need the local Gabinde and maybe a team from that rule board to be present when we discuss this, to hear the other side of the story, what is wrong with this and why do they say so. So I do agree with the other conversation.
Someone from the opposition, parties, could Arden have a mandate to contact Judge Nkabindi? Okay, then we'll proceed along those lines, and I will report back to the committee as soon as I've spoken to Judge Nkabindi.
Time-wise, as soon as the rules are debated in 3 years, is that, and when was the commission of Section 10?
I'm not just 100% sure. Now, it was amended to cover the 3 year period, but I'm not exactly sure when it was done. I think we're still within that period.
Okay, then moving on, I think the upcoming Jeremy, do you want to take the regional courts or should we do mandating procedures? Okay, let's quickly then maybe deal with mandating procedures. Let's do mandating because apparently we need to vote on that next week. Members, there are letters which I hope you have. Okay, Lolly will distribute them. It's letters from the Department of Justice addressed to the Select Committee of the NCOP on proposed recommendations that were made by the Justice Department to the mandating procedures bill. And if Mr. Lavaskachin could maybe just take us through those. And then Mrs. Bauer is here from the NCOP to then just report to us which of those recommendations have been addressed in the bill. Members will recall that what we have before us is the B version of the bill. And which of those recommendations have not been accepted by the NCOP, and then we can have a discussion on that. So over to you, Mr. Lavaskachin. And yeah, Mr. Rudman, if you and your team want to excuse. That's fine. Okay. Great, thanks, Mr. Lavaskachin.
Thank you, I think members will know that all these proposals from the department are of a technical nature. Some of them have been addressed in the bill that was eventually introduced into Parliament. I don't know whether you wanted to go through each one of them, because it's a long, long list, as you can see.
Maybe we take us through the most pressing ones, those that have been incorporated, because it's mentioned to us that the bill's been, been accepted. Those that have not been accepted, maybe we can just have your comments from the colleagues in the NCOP.
Okay. Okay, we saw this paragraph one.
Someone deal with the issue that I raised about the legislation being passed in a reasonable time.
Yeah, I was hoping Mrs. Bowers has indicated that she will deal with that once we've gone through the line by line. Okay, Mr. Lusaki.
The proposal mentioned in paragraph 1 has been accommodated in the new bill, so as the one in number paragraph 2. Then if you go to 3.1 section and to get it at the same time to the content or to the bill itself. On page 2 of the bill, under the heading chapter 2, you will note it starts with procedures in respect of mandates. But if you then look at the two clauses under that chapter, maybe 3 and 4, refer to requirements. So the department proposed that the word procedures in the heading of chapter 2 should be substituted with requirements. Again, it's really technical, but that was one of our previous proposals which have not been accepted.
Okay, sitting here from the committee, I don't think there could be any problem with the reading changing to requirements, but let's just hear from Mrs. Bowers.
Thank you, Chairperson. Good morning, members. There is no problem with the technical amendment, so there would be no problem.
Members, happy?
Chairperson, then, so we have 3.2, what is the department proposes there is that the sequence of clauses 5, 6 and 7 be changed. The reason being that clause 5, dealing with legislative mandates, refers to negotiating and final mandates. We say that clause 5 must become clause 7, the reason being that if you at the moment read clause 5, you have no idea what negotiating mandate or final mandate means. So that's why we say first, and that's also the sequence of exactly that. So first negotiating, then final mandate, and then legislative mandate. That is the essence of our proposal in paragraph 3.2.
Yeah, I thought that was rather strange because you would expect that the sections in the bill would follow the practical the way it should work. So yeah, was that accepted or no, not?
No, that was not
accepted. No. Chairperson, just to indicate that I spoke to the colleague that was involved from the onset with the committee when they deliberated the bill, and he indicated that the committee didn't provide any reason for most of the proposed amendments that have not been included into the bill, and that we have looked at it and we find it strange because it does make sense, it's illogical, it's technical, and it should be the way Mr. Lambert has proposed it.
Logical.
It reminds me of what Langenwolf, the famous Afrikaans writer, said when he was member of the House of Assembly, and then he was elected to the upper house, to the Senate, and he said, "Ek het nou na bowe geval."
So 3.3 has been accepted. Then 4.1A has not been accepted. That again says it's very technical. In clause 1, where the head of delegation is defined, the definition is head of delegation. But if you go to clause 8.1, it reference is made to head of the delegation. So for purposes of consistency, which is not a major issue, but for purposes of consistency, the department feels that either the in clause 8.1 should be deleted, or the definition of head of delegation should be changed by the inclusion of the.
Okay, so just either we put the in both, or we take the out, so in. Yeah. Was that accepted? Mrs. Bowers was frowning.
To me, semantics, Chairperson. Really, I would think that if it was in the contents of those 8 months, at least the provincial legislature must transfer authority to vote on the head of the delegation. Now, in it uses a sentence, obviously, but when you find it in the definition, it's a term. So I would prefer that the burn be retained in the clause itself, in the context of God.
Is there any members who feel strongly about the use of the word burn?
Members will note that some of these proposals are very petty, but being a drafter for about 15, 16 years now, you sort of tend to pick up and strive for consistency. So, okay, the next one is a bit more complicated. That's paragraph B1. If the members look at the definition of legislative mandate, that's on page 3. So, to cast the vote on a question contemplated in section 64, 74, 76, 78. Now 54 and 78, those two sections do not deal with legislation. It deals with the appointment of the chairperson, the chairperson of the National Council of Provinces and matters pertaining to the Mediation Committee. So the department raises the question whether a legislative mandate is required in respect of those two issues, and that this matter has not been addressed in the public domain or after the submission of our committee.
So would it be correct then to say that for those two clauses you would need either a negotiating mandate or a voting mandate, but not a legislative mandate?
That's a question that we raise further on because it's not clear from the law.
Okay, Mrs. Bowers.
Thank you, Chairperson. Maybe I can say that when this clause or the definition of legislative mandate emanates from the initial draft of the bill, and the committee actually stuck to or confirmed that they agree with just the thinking behind clustering the different sections of the Constitution where a mandate is required. Although specifically, as you answered correctly, section 64 and 78 are not matters pertaining to legislation. Section 64 of the Constitution deals with the election of the chairperson of the National Council of Provinces, and section 78 deals with the Mediation Committee. Section 78 actually provides for in itself, the Constitution in that section gives an indication of how voting should take place. So whether or not that is omitted from that definition really wouldn't matter because the Constitution does make reference to that voting that would take place there. Section 64, the election is also prescribed in the Constitution in Part A of Schedule 3. Part A of Schedule 3. So on that point, I think the committee could make up its mind, and I'm sure the select committee, when the bill is referred back to them, can also listen to reasons why it was found. So, yeah. But, Madam Chairperson, since my colleague is coming in, maybe he can add another view on that matter, because that is one of the issues that we weren't able to discuss in detail. So maybe he can also just make a comment on that.
Yeah, please feel free to interrupt us at any stage. Members, how do the members feel? Do we take those two sections, do we take that out, or do we leave it in?
It seems to me that those two sections are irrelevant. I mean, it shouldn't be there because it does not deal with the legislative command. So I propose to take it out if I'm correct.
Okay, then if I can note that you remove those two sections. Okay, Mr. Duffy, then?
Thank you, Mr. Duffy. All our proposals have been incorporated in the bill. So we have B, D, E, and X. We then send to 4.2. which is consequential to one of our previous comments, maybe substitute procedure with requirements, so that's merely consequential. Paragraph 4.3 of the letter that deals with clause 3. That one now falls away in view of the approval of the decision to delete section 64 and 78 from the bill, so that one will then also be supported by, or has to be supported by, the committee. It might be prescribed to the committee what to do. Four point four, that's merely the substitution of the word as in the clause 4. Yeah, the heading of clause 4. In the content of the bill, designation of head of delegation, in this heading is three, designation as, so it's consequential.
So just for consistency, when you go to the draft, it's decided if you want to use as or of.
In clause, paragraph 4.5, that deals with clause 5, or maybe before we go there, this is another issue that I picked up, is that if you look at clause 3, it contains a long list of requirements in respect of final mandates. And then it says, paragraph E, follow the format described in schedule 2. But there is no such list in respect of negotiating mandates. So the question is, should such a list be included? Is such a list necessary in view of the fact that schedule 2 already contains the special format in which those mandates have to be submitted? So the question that the committee must decide on whether we should include a list or whether we delete the list in view of the schedules.
Yeah, I mean, this will remember that this is the point that Mr. Hubert made at the previous meeting. That it appears that the requirements of the two clauses differ. So, yeah, maybe from members, if I could hear, do you want to follow, are we going to put out an extensive list, or do you want to go with the sort of wording that is used in clause 6, which is more of a general position? And then also, Mrs. Bowers, if you could maybe explain if there was a particular reason why the NCOP did it this way.
Thank you, Chairperson. The reasoning behind having a list specifically for the final mandate and then having the corresponding form was that the final mandate is seen as the important mandate. The negotiating mandate is obviously negotiation can take place, and that they felt that that kind of description wasn't necessary in terms of that, but that if the form is there to be filled in, that would suffice. So, but that was basically the reasoning behind that.
Members happy with that explanation? Okay, so we'll keep it as it is.
In the of clause 5, you'll see that refer to the bill referred to in section 74(1)(d), 2(d), 3(b), and 8. Now the department is of the view that the reference to 8 is unnecessary because 8 does not, 8 refers back to section 74(3)(b), and therefore we feel that the reference to subsection 8 could possibly be deleted. Section 74(8), just find it quickly, starts off by providing a bill referred to in subsection 3B, or any part of that bill, may not be passed by the NCOP unless the province is concerned has passed it. So in other words, it refers back to the, like the constitution that we passed last year. So that's why we feel that that reference is not really necessary, doesn't mean anything.
But also,
instead of
some
handling,
it can't do any harm. It's probably
just
for clarity,
isn't it?
But
yep. No, it can't do any harm.
Thank you, sir. I think it's for the purposes of emphasis. Like the purpose and the thing is that I don't think it makes any harm to, it does any harm to the situation. Thank you, sir.
Members, do we leave it in? Do we take it out? Leave it in. Okay.
Citizen, paragraph 4.5.2 of our letter. If you look at the definition of legislative mandate, paragraph E, second page 3, paragraph E reads, and any other national legislation which requires a decision of the NKP. The fourth question is whether that reference should not also be included in clause 5. Because clause 5 now refers to all the bills mentioned in the definition clause except that last paragraph.
And I take your point, Mrs. Barrett. Why? No. My colleague and I have discussed this, and we actually also noted that if you retain E, any other national legislation would refer to Section 75 legislation, and that we would agree with Johan to say that that is then not a necessary requirement to have an E, then maybe just to end it off the D. Because any other national legislation would refer to Section 75, and Section 75 matters would not require mandates in the NCLP.
Thank you, Chad. My colleague is quite clear. We have discussed this matter. And like she said, any other matter that requires the decision of the NCLP also include Section 75 here. The alternative might be that any other matter affecting the provinces which may require the decision of the NCLP.
So do you want to add that to the same value of completeness and clarity then? Just give me that wording again, please.
Any other matter affecting the provinces which may require the decision of the NCLP.
Okay, so we're adding a new C. Any other matter affecting provinces which decision is okay, which requires a decision by the NCLP, so that would be in the subsection C then. Remember? So, happy.
Any other matter or any other legislation?
Now, if I understand them correctly, Dr. Jobber, they're saying that there won't be legislation because all other legislation would be Section 75, which would be in, as it might, it would be any other matter. And not legislation.
Yes, that of course also requires a consequential amendment to the definition of legislative mandate. So it's changing the paragraph E of the definition and adding that new amended E then as a paragraph C on the clause 5. Okay, so we have 4.53. The committee has already agreed on that one, so that change that will have to be effective. So we have 4.54, that's the sequence. The committee has already agreed to that proposal. The one in paragraph 4.6, that one is not relevant anymore, seeing that it has been affected by, or it has been affected by the select committee. Paragraph 4.62 also deals with Section 74 and 78, so that one should be regarded as having been accepted by the committee. 4.63 deals with the sequence, which the committee has already accepted. 4.71 has already been accepted. It was again the issue of 6478. 472 is the sequence which has been accepted by the committee. And then, as far as Clause 8 is concerned, Chairperson, our proposal, you'll see that the department proposed a redrafting of the whole Clause 8. Our proposal in respect of Clause 2 are not relevant anymore, but we still feel that the way that we propose Clause 8, Clause 1 should be amended. It reads better because it must confer the authority to vote on the head and then put on to cast the vote. So we feel that the two words to vote, if those two words are deleted, the sentence will read in our view maybe better. But that is technical, but for the committee to decide.
Let me hear members on it. I don't think much turns on it, but let me hear the members of this committee.
It's needed.
Yeah.
Are we now on 8
the voting mandate? Yeah, and they're proposing that we delete the word that you vote. Although it is a voting mandate, so...
I agree with that, Mr.
Mrs. Barrett, is there a reason why they kept the word to vote in this legislation?
Chairperson, we've also looked at this proposal and we actually agree with you on that because it does enter towards the end of the sentence. It's maybe just to read it so that the hour sounds. A provincial legislature must confer the authority on the head of the delegation or delegates designated by the head of the delegation to cast a vote in a NCLB plenary. So it does bring across what is expected.
But
I don't think
so.
Be a problem
to
the end of what I propose.
Okay, Episode 9.
That one has been expected, Chairperson. Then, of course, consequential amendments will have to be affected to the memorandum on the offset of the bill. And then the last issue from the department side, Chairperson, is that the schedules, every time only refers to the name of the bill, the number of the bill, that's Schedule 1, as well as Schedule 2. In view of the fact that we have not added any other matter affecting provinces, the question is why shouldn't we amend the schedules then to move away only from bills but perhaps to put in another line where they can ask if there's anything else? Because we feel that the way that the schedules have been formulated only provide for bills and no other matter.
Let's just think of other instances where the NCLB might have to work. What other types of decisions would it cover everything to put in another line saying other? Or are you proposing a completely separate schedule or just an extra line in the existing schedule?
Maybe just a new line in the existing schedule to provide for the possibility if there's other matters. I don't think we have to survive. If we go to the sector, then we have to add two new schedules for voting and negotiating matters. Or final and negotiating. So maybe just a new line in each of those two schedules.
Can I hear the colleagues from the NCLB on this?
Section 65 of the Constitution says, Section 65.1b, or questions before the NCLB are agreed to. So I thought just in terms of in conforming with the Constitution, maybe we can say bill or question before, unless my colleague would like to just propose another term.
Okay, so instead of saying matter, then earlier on you would say question, just to make it in line with the Constitution. happy members? Members are very quiet. Okay, so then we'll add that line to the schedule. Mr. Lovisaki, anything else?
Chairperson, no, not as far as the bill itself is concerned. Maybe just to add, as a department, you will note from this letter that we, the department, does not have any objection against the principles contained in the bill. Our proposals were merely of a technical nature. And then perhaps the last thing from my side is procedure. Who will be responsible, because this will now require formal amendments, or these proposals will require formal amendments to the bill, and who will be responsible for preparing those amendments?
That was the question that I was going to address to you, Mr. Lovisaki. my thinking would be, and maybe if the whip can assist, my thinking would be that would have to come from the NCO. Yeah, or we would just have to do a straightforward justice amendment. I don't know.
I don't know if my colleague here is proposing that or is suggesting that the committee secretary is not responsible for doing that, because we assume that this is the normal course of events, and therefore we should follow the normal process itself.
No, I think it can only come from this committee, I think.
Can you come to
that? Okay, well, in any event, we'll deal with it between myself and the work, and we'll get back to you if you need to. But in any event, we'll have it ready, because we need to vote on this one next week. It's Thursday, but probably the most important point is the point that Mrs. Swart raised last week. So did he, Mrs. Bowers, or you or your colleagues ready to respond to that point?
Which question is that?
It was the issue that Mrs. Swart raised about the senior constitutional obligation in the section 65(2) and the fact that there's been a delay in bringing this bill. Maybe, Mr. Swart, if you want to just, for those members who weren't here, just...
Thank you, Chair. Yes, the requirement is that the legislation that's required in terms of the Constitution. Now, Item 21(1) of Schedule 6 requires that such legislation must be passed within a reasonable period of the passing of the Constitution. The Constitution, we know, was passed in February of 1997, now 11 years later. And I did refer to the UDM ACDP court case, which found the floor cutting legislation had not been passed within a reasonable period, and that was in 2002, that's 6 years ago. So obviously the argument is that can it, by any stretch of the imagination, be considered that now is a reasonable period, 6 years later? Now, even if you set aside that constitutional court case, which had a specific time period for floor cutting, I don't think, and I think that we need some legal opinion or something on that, but I've got a major concern with whether this mandatory procedure can be considered to have been passed within a reasonable period of the Constitution being passed. Bearing in mind that it now affects all legislation that the NCLP is going to be passed from now on. The interim provisions allow that they set their own procedures, so we're not looking back retrospectively, but progressively, all legislation that is passed could then be contested on the basis that the voting procedure in terms of this legislation was not passed within a reasonable period. And I hate that, and that is the only reason I'm raising it. I've got no principal objections to the content, but I'm concerned about later litigation that could emanate by any person that's unhappy with a piece of legislation that's passed.
Yeah, like we indicated last time, the very difficult question for the station to respond to, but nevertheless, I think the Constitution is very clear. I accept that the Constitution says the legislation must be passed within a reasonable time. And of course, what is reasonable depends on the circumstances of And therefore, if a matter arises, it might be that there is an explanation why the sensation behaves. I do not think, I have the difficulty, Chair, in judging the matter as to whether if it comes before the court, will come to a conclusion that the sensation was not passed within a reasonable time. It may well be that prima facie 11 years is not a reasonable time. But like I'm saying, it will depend if this matter comes before the court as to whether the court arrives at that conclusion or it doesn't. Thank you, Chair.
Thanks, Mr. Swart. I take your point. My thinking just at this point is the longer we sit on it, the more we delay it, the more unreasonable the time becomes. Would it not be a way forward to express something to that effect, maybe in our report, when we process or for the chief, maybe not as a reservation, but just to say that that the committee expresses itself on the delay and the reasonable time. I mean, the longer we leave it, the more unreasonable, the more we exacerbate the already existing problem. I don't know.
Your co-chair raised the issue that it's a relatively straightforward piece of legislation, not complex. We deal with complex legislation, and the explanations are not satisfactory as to why it's been delayed so far. So I don't know how it will be. If they can't motivate it here, how they will motivate it before a court of law that it's taken 11 years for the piece of legislation to be passed. But I do think we need to expect, but I think we might need to just talk a little bit about it, because by putting that in the resolution, you are alerting people to that problem. So, but we are in a bit of a catch-22 situation. We've got to pass it, but we would obviously have to reserve our position on the bill. We've got nothing, no concern, but can it be said to be in a reasonable time? I've got a great difficulty with that. Where the Constitutional Court has already given an indication.
There's
already,
we are in
test to but there is a need to pass the legislation, so I've got no principle to the content. So maybe we need to just talk a little bit more about it amongst ourselves as a way forward.
Yeah, and then these parties could go back and take it to their study groups and do their caucuses, and then maybe let's solve this issue then before we go on to voting on it next week.
The only way out is a constitutional amendment, which one doesn't want to go that route. But at the moment, until such legislation is passed, then everything it's fine. The process continues. There's no problem with legislation being passed now. But I need guidance as well. It's an issue that I haven't been satisfactorily explained, and maybe someone can assist us.
Didn't we catch 22 a lot? We just have to proceed with the legislation. There is no option. And I have I've got a view that the court will not interfere with the legislation, the Constitution Court will, because they have been operating without this piece of legislation. In fact, it's somewhat of a superfluous exercise and there had been no question about the validity of the process or nothing, so I think we must just go proceed, and for us we are doing it within a reasonable time since it appears on our agenda.
Yeah, I think I'm going to share with you, but I mean I hear Mr. Swart's point, I mean that you can't, I mean 11 years is really it. Not ideal. Mr.
Labuskaka,
you seem like you want to add
something. What I want to add is one of two options. Either to pass this committee, either to pass this bill, or go the other way, constitutional amendment, because that was what the UDN case said. Because it was for a long time, you now have to put it in the constitution. And surely, these are not the kind of provisions that we want to include in a constitution. It's not a controversial bill, like the floor crossing in the UDM case, so I doubt it. I have a view with the author, but I doubt it whether any court or whether anybody will attack this piece of legislation.
Okay, so can we proceed along the lines that Dr. Delph will propose? Here from the ANC.
Yes.
All right, so then we'll affect any specific changes, and then be ready to vote on Tuesday. And I
Thank you, sir. May we be excused?
Definitely. Thank you for your time, and thank you, Mr. Lovescoffey, for...
Welcome everybody. We are now dealing with the jurisdiction of the regional magistrate court as well as the co-chair of the life, Shaggy Onuma, chapter 13, as to how we are going to proceed today. But we have just got that we need to deal with the letter we received from Joan. Quite a long letter. And then thereafter we'll be dealing with the deal clause by clause. But before dealing with the deal clause by clause, I was of the view that maybe we give the department some opportunity to tell us any further development since our last meeting on the question of the training course, the registrar. I see even in this letter that she was saying it all about training, right? And this is the opportunity that we have the department tell us.
You can shape things the way you want, but I thought we agreed just before the meeting exactly what you said, that what we do is what you say. The only thing I need to add, which you wouldn't know because you've been out of town and I only got to know yesterday, Lori, we've got another magistrate who wants to appear before the committee. Now, I don't need to discuss this. We've agreed that Parliament should be as open as possible, but finally we set the rules and, you know, people can't come to us. You know, 1 minute before we're voting on the bill with a major submission. But in this case, it's fine. We have got a judge. Who's the magistrate wants to come? Mr. Zimbardo wants to come. I think it's fine that you tell him Tuesday. Who's Mr. Zimbardo? Is he keep down there?
Yes.
Oh. He's quite a key figure, isn't he, JP?
Yes, it's a chief magistrate in Cape Town, but I don't know his capacity to come in, whether for any of the formation or for himself, etc. But I know it's this here.
Yeah. As you know, as long as he's a South African citizen,
yeah,
he has the right to come. The matter of his status is between him and his structure.
Yeah.
I say this because now there's an article in the Cape Argus I asked Lolly to photocopy. Have you distributed it? Yeah. Okay. You know what amazes me about my friend Lolly? She will do all the hard work, meaning photocopy 40 pages. Ask her to photocopy one little article from the Cape Army, so I can get that. But I'd rather have the 40 pages than the one lolly. Is that a way? Oh, so you give it to me? It's me right. It's in the public domain. Two magistrates did an interview with the press, and they complained bitterly that, you know, what we're doing here is actually going to deny access to justice, that the current system is fine. That is their right. They're also magistrates. That's between them and their organization. Anybody wants to come here, we've said this before, this is the Parliament of South Africa. Anybody wants to come to this committee, we've agreed they can come. But there must be limits also. So I think we have this magistrate, and we distribute this letter, and we'd like the department also, I'm not interested in the article, respond to the article, and I agree with you, that's the way we go. Just to be fair to Comrade JB, this is a very complex bill, technically, because it's amending the 1944 Act. And whereas I've been chairing for 9 years and JB, it's his first opportunity at this,
Yes, please return to me and say, you know, what, but otherwise, you know, do what you want to do. Keep on running.
I think it would be important to check how far we want to go, take into consideration that it is nearly 20 past 12 now. Whether it would be possible that we can come back at 2, but I think the house is the same, and also use an hour to continue.
Christina told you about this. The stuff I emailed to Lolly, you see all the numbering has disappeared. So you've got a copy of a report on our progress. Now, I don't know what happened to my computer. Interesting, Christina emailed it to the same time I emailed it to you, which is 2:05 in the morning. And there's lots of mistakes in it. So this morning I reworked it. Hundreds just will not exist. She's just about photocopying 20 copies. We really must, because we're not meeting on Friday, we must, in principle, accept our program and adopt it next week. So, I would need 10 minutes slot for that. Now, we may meet till 1 o'clock. What's the problem meeting till 1? Those who want to meet between 2 and 3, it's fine by me. I'm not available personally. But go ahead and meet, because I'm JB is here and so on. Personally, I'm not, I don't have to be here in any case, because JB is chilling. But I would urge that we sit at least from 12:45. Because we have to please look at the report. And meet through one, and then if people want to meet at 2, that's fine. That's good to you, congratulations. And we'll be available. Can I suggest one other thing? You see, I think next Tuesday, we must finish this first. And then the only thing that remains is formal adoption. Because the child justice bill must start next Wednesday. But we got mandating. Well, look, the program is about to come to you now. Can you give me a few minutes? Just getting a photocopy, right? But this bill, I don't think we need to sit beyond another morning sitting. And then it's finished, really. Then we just decide when we're going to vote on it once we deliver the implementation plan and we do the report, which Lolly will have to take major responsibility for preparing with Christine. And then I'll work through it. And with you, Jamie, we'll do it together, the report to Parliament. Okay.
Let me start by asking or establishing whether are any of us here who are available to meet this afternoon in case we don't finish by 1 o'clock. Ms. Melody? Ms. Melody?
Chairperson, can you go to the work meeting at 1? So I don't think we can do it by 2 o'clock. So myself and probably the landlord.
Also, okay, it seems also not available. Yeah, let us then say we will try to finish everything before 1 o'clock, what we can manage today.
Okay.
What
we can do is just allocate at 12:45, 10 minutes you need to just take us to our report, and let's accept the report in principle. I mean, not report, sorry, the program, and we vote on it next week, that becomes our program for the year.
Right, then let us deal with the letter from Jonathan. I've read it. I received it this morning. I was trying to go through it. And quite a long letter. Let alone the fault in which it is written. Mr. Jirangi, maybe your comment on the letter.
Thank you, Chair. I'll start off. I'm sure that my colleagues might want to add. Just for your benefit, and if the committee agrees, I'd like to reflect very briefly on this newspaper report first. Of course, you'll see that the content is very similar, although I might have just taken it a little further. Just a few remarks there, Chair. For some reason, there seems to be a perception within certain circles in the magistracy that the bill is focused on the careers of regional court magistrates. Now, I do not know why it is, but if you read this report, and I must say the one up but has a heading magistrate slam those proposals on the board. It's not the same heading as it would be in the parlance, but it is exactly the same report. I think there's a bit of sensationalism involved there. It suggests that two magistrates hit out at the proposed law. warning that it would deny ordinary people access to justice. First is to remark that as the law stands at the moment, we have district courts, regional courts with only criminal jurisdiction, and we have divorce courts with divorce jurisdiction. The bill, as we discussed the last time, does not take any single thing away that we presently have. The divorce courts will change in name, as they will be absorbed by the regional courts, which should actually enhance the access to justice aspect, because there are many more regional courts in the country. And although originally the divorce courts will continue to exist as they are at the moment, quite obviously once they merge with the regional courts, we've got a lot of scope for increasing those justice services beyond what we currently have in divorce courts. But I think we should stress that what we're not, even though we're abolishing divorce courts in law, we're not abolishing the divorce courts in practice. What we're doing is we're changing the name, and we're saying you now become part of the regional court. But those courts will be there, the officers doing the work will be there, the procedures will be left intact, the ease of access will specifically be taken care of in this bill so as to ensure that we preserve those elements that make those courts more accessible, cheaper, user-friendly than the High Court, for example. So I think that is a really major misconception if you read this report. Those courts are not being abolished, we're not taking away service that we currently have there. I don't think it's necessary to comment anymore. If you read the report, you'll say, you'll see remarks, and I'm reading for the third last paragraph, it says, for example, if you look prior to 1999, people couldn't get divorced if they didn't have money to pay attorneys and advocates to appear for them in the High Court. Now, I'm not actually going into too much detail there, but that's an indication of the flaws, the factual flaws upon which this kind of comments are founded. I mean, 1999, you can go back, those courts were established in 1929 originally. They were deracialized in 98, but I mean, I really need not go into the history of all that, but I think the point should just be made that we're not abolishing them, we're actually increasing the services being rendered by those courts. Chair, and I think we can leave that then turn to the submission by Jalata. Now, Jalata's submission, and I'm sure my colleague Jason will have a lot to add here, but I want to make just a few remarks. Just to rub the eye a bit of the committee into it, I've had the benefit of changing the font in which the submission was made, so I think I can read mine a bit easier than you can read yours. I'm not going to pay too much attention to the introduction, based on pointing out, as my colleague said the last time, that this matter formally, the matter of the jurisdiction of the civil court, of the regional court, formally featured on the agenda of the Magistrates Conference in 2007, that was held in September 2007. So the first formal discussions started at that stage already. There were subcommissions within that conference that discussed this issue, and it was some part of the report on the Magistrates Conference, but I'll leave it to that. I don't think we need to engage from the department side with Charles about these suggestions about consultation or not. I will leave that to them. Regarding the provisions of the bill, it's interesting to note that they draw attention to the purpose of the proposed legislation in the preamble is to promote the development of judicial expertise among the ranks of magistrates to review and broaden the pool of fit and proper persons qualifying for appointment to the superior court. I find it noteworthy that they start off by referring to the second bullet under the purpose of the preamble. The third bullet says, pending the further rationalization of the courts, which is consequently the purpose of the Act to enhance access to justice by conferring jurisdiction on courts for regional divisions, which are distributed throughout the national territory to deal with certain civil matters, etc. That is really the main focus, enhance access to justice. Now, the second bullet that they refer to quite correctly does say promote the development of judicial expertise among the ranks of magistrates with a view to broadening the pool of fit and proper persons qualifying for the appointment to the Superior Court. It does not say to development of judicial expertise among the ranks of regional magistrates.
It says magistrates.
And I want to make that point very clearly, because through there's a line stating throughout the submission that the bill is aimed at enhancing the career opportunities of regional magistrates. Now that should be, that will be a consequence of the bill. It will be a consequence that we will obviously afford small opportunity regional court magistrates, and specifically there we will be broadening the pool of people who are fit and proper persons, but as a result of the implementation of the bill, that benefit would go throughout the whole of the magistracy. Could it mean that there would be more magistrates subject to more training at district and regional court level, because obviously most of the regional court appointees come from the district court. And it makes it only logical that once the regional or the district court magistrate has a further career prospect, that they can now look to elevation to the regional court bench, they will more focus on the development of the civil adjudication expertise. And you will see that this theme is repeated throughout the submission. And I also want to stress, I think you're not necessarily from the partner side at odds with many of the sentiments expressed in the submission. We just think that they're not, that they're failing to interpret the meaning of the bill correctly. And then if on a proper interpretation of the bill, Joata was realized that they were actually in agreement on the objects and on what they suggest the main gist of this legislation should be. I'm not looking at paragraphs 2 and 3 of the submission, Chair. It relates to some background on the Judicial Service Commission and those kind of issues. I'm turning to paragraph 4, which refers to clause 3 of the bill. Then they've got this issue about training in some detail. I don't think the members with respect should bear in mind that we are, in terms of the existing draft that is before the committee picked up this point that there are certain possible flaws in the training clause. At the last meeting, there were already proposals made with regard to how we can amplify those provisions, and in fact, there is a newer distribution today, a document dated 27 February 2008, that is actually added to that provision. So the problem that Jahata envisaged with regard to training was the perception that the training is solely aimed at the regional court magistrates, and that a district court civil magistrate would be excluded from any training or appointment to the regional court as far as the civil work is concerned. Now, I think when we get to the discussion of the bill itself, it will become clear, and I think we've covered those areas. Chair, paragraph 5 of the submission, they're referring to the difference between the equality court and the school to deal with training. I just want to remark here that all the examples here that they are looking at would seem to be hypothetical, which relates to possible eventuality that may or may not happen in the future, but they obviously think that it's worth bearing in mind when it comes to developing your implementation program, which we will clearly get to. See paragraph 7. Just to illustrate the point that I said, we are actually not disagreeing with Jahata and many of the sentiments expressed in here. They're saying, for example, that, and I'm reading from paragraph 7, thickening appointees to the regional court bench from the district court will open up us in the district court for new appointees and create civil court training opportunities in an environment that already has an established judicial administrative infrastructure for those who had no access to those posts previously. Similarly, it would open up new career opportunities for experienced and competent district court magistrates to adjudicate civil disputes at a higher level, initially in the regional court and eventually in the superior court, that is transformation. Then they go on to say, and that this is what we cannot quite fathom, they then go on to say that why they perceive this bill as preventing the positive things that they've just stated there in paragraph 7. And I just want to make the point that as we envisage from the department side, as the bill is to be implemented, as the provisions are to be interpreted, this is exactly what should happen in practice. Most of your regional court bench would be appointed from the district courts, civil and and criminal work, and it will open up career opportunities for the experienced competent district court magistrate at in the higher level and eventually in the superior courts. Then paragraph 8, I need to remark that citing the preamble referred to above has as its purpose an exclusivity that may be perceived as unfairly discriminatory towards district court magistrates for the reasons aforesaid. Now I leave it to the members to make their own judgment on that. That statement, I could say that from the department side, we cannot read anything like that into the preamble. In paragraph 9, I beg your pardon.
I'm not going to leave the municipality, I'm going to say, I leave it to the members to make up
their
mind. Honestly, it's so
dismissive,
you know, that, anyway, okay,
I'm not
judgmental. I'm not judgmental. But it's finally human.
Well, see, there's another interesting point in paragraph 9. The bias in favor of regional court magistrates being singled out for appointment to the superior courts, they read that somewhere, will have the effect of impeding transformation both in the regional and superior courts on the basis that a greater majority of regional court magistrates are white males. In fact, 151 of the 328 regional magistrates, male and female, are white males. Now, my calculation, 151 is 302, which constitute a minority, I think. But leave it at that. Then, in paragraph 10, referring to the increase of penal jurisdiction, again, we agree with the point of making by drawing appointees from the district court, the capacity to cope with the increased civil court workload in the regional courts will be enhanced far more efficiently than by sending regional magistrates on a training course first. That is clearly correct, and it is encouraged that that would happen. But we have to deal with the reality that there might be, and it's probably necessary, to just refresh the existing incumbents of regional court magistrates. They do need some civil education, refreshing. But as I said, we're in agreement with him. Most of the appointees would be coming from the district courts when it comes to filling vacancies in the regional court. Chair, I've got on the regional courts, so similar to what we've read in the paper, and there were also some comments to the committee about the efficiency. And efficiency and what is the other word, the effectiveness of the divorce courts. The divorce courts have been complemented quite considerably with regard to the service that's trending currently. They are rendering, and as I said earlier, I do not know why there is this perception that we aim to abolish these courts. The idea is very clearly to retain all that services and to retain all the good things and all the user-friendly elements and characteristics of the divorce court as they presently exist. I do not know, Chair, whether any of my colleagues would like to add to that, but that's as far as I can respond.
Any addition?
Thank you, Nancy. I just make two comments. Firstly, we had a conference for today. The 15th and 16th September. I have a draft report of the conference. It was attended by 557 magistrates and judges and SUA department members. The Minister Olsen, the Chief Justice Olsen, with an address. It had commission, day one until 12, it was mainly discussion around the theme. One theme focused on single judiciary, an element of the single judiciary, but they tried to harmonize the lower court so that you create and the Chief Justice, the Deputy Chief Justice speech was very eloquent that the current arrangement is not conducive to promote single judiciary because it doesn't promote a kind of a conduit career pathing from the entry level of a messenger to a judge because there are courts, original courts, which do not, some of the things are done by the court, etc. and was interested. After it was discussed, there was a commission dedicated for discussion. Now, then report is going to be public, going to be in the public domain very quickly. But I was just looking at the issue now, as my colleague was talking. For the commission to deal with human judiciary. In fact, not only the second president of Joasa attended, he presented a paper on human judiciary where this issue was discussed. And I wanted to mention one specific thing which was coming from JB's concern, coming to the report, about Cape Town. What the message of the conference said, magistrate, not the both matters are dealt with in the district court as part of a parent policy change. This may be legal cause because they are still not accessible to people in terms of physical distance. That's what necessary. The two matters in Cape Town, which is in Cape Town, are not appointed in Cape Town. They are not appointed by Mr. Zimbabwe. They are appointed in PE. They are part of a southern divorce court in Port Elizabeth, but they sit in Cape Town every day. Now, we want to help them. We say, if you want to appoint them, don't want to be running around to PE to check in the current PM conversion. We want it to be integrated within the Cape Town structure because the original matter is in Cape Town. But they've got no interaction or relationship with the original matter in Cape Town because of the system. Now, that's what the bill seeks to do. The bill seeks to basically to integrate and harmonize the system. And those are the facts which are not coming from the department. I said by the magistrate themselves, which are recorded in a case, etc. Well, I was just giving an example that it might be so that other half of the people at the conference may not have been informed by Joanne about the program, which is represented there. And this may come back to you. But I'm saying the issue was discussed at the conference for over 2 days. Now, one of the aspects of this LLB, there was a detailed presentation on the LLB at the commission, both at the commission and at plenary. And the LLB, and the issue was always raised that LLB, the way it's structured, it denies career opportunities for those magistrates in the system who never had it before. Because if you say the LLB becomes your entry point for regional magistrates, it means you are magistrate. The anomaly is currently because of the lack of civil jurisdiction. When the high court looks for judges, they take the district court. Because most of the high court is motions, whatever, etc. They don't take as a judge, as a magistrate with 10 years experience in the regional court. Although the regional magistrate can have got extended jurisdiction, they can give licenses. But they are not automatically considered to enter the High Court because they lack the framework. Now the High Court, the Chief Justice and everybody must go there to the District Court and take a magistrate who don't have the level of experience at the regional level. Now the Chief Justice says, that must be corrected. You can't have a system that falls outside this terrain of the judiciary. And that's what it seems to correct. But then there were views expressed, which come very strongly in the submission. That if you do that, you will basically jeopardize the opportunity of an ordinary magistrate on the LLB of advancing to the High Court because we're doing that. Now we've said the LLB may no longer be an issue. It was an issue at the time when we had 2 degrees. LLB was a postgraduate. Now LLB is an entry level. Every lawyer got LLB, etc. It's not an issue. But it's not there. It may not be there when it's been the statute book. In a long time, because it is not there for any other circumstance. And we did emphasize that whether somebody has passed LLG or LLG, the president and the minister are guided by the JSC and the Magistrate Commission in appointing competences. Does not mean that if you remove LLG or in the law now, people will automatically go to there's an assessment process which should guide the appointment process, etc. So the critical element is what fit and proper person and case at the end of the day. And the case and the medical commission are very critical in coming with elements as well. So these are the points I wanted to raise in terms of the submission. But I just also wanted to emphasize that we are working well with Joasa. In fact, they helped us pull one of the first and the most successful conference for magistrates. where these things were discussed for the first time in Tantra. They brought their membership across all the courts. They brought them in numbers, and they participated in these issues, and these are very discussed issues. And we believe that we will continue to engage the people that can find solutions to issues. But no, both in the submission, they don't say, don't extend this bill to regional courts. Say, they say, allow magistrates in our ranks who are senior enough to do the matter. To me, they acknowledge one thing, that one, divorce matters per se and civil matters are complicated matters. They do not want any magistrate. So they ask you what we call a flex factor. A flex factor says any magistrate uses every matter, don't have the hierarchy. Give any case to any person, etc. Then we argue and say matters depend on complexity. That's why a magistrate who has not been exposed at the complex issues, both in terms of production and practice, will find it very difficult to engage senior counselors who are going to appear there and argue before them. They won't be able to resolve this issue. So we believe in the kind of system that creates the layers, because it allows, even the jurisdiction, how it's defined. It allows complex matters in the first one and less complex matters in the first one. Now they advocate for a flex structure. I'm a magistrate, give me everything. We say no. You have to have experience and some qualifications to deal with other aspects. Now, they acknowledge here that don't give it to the regional magistrate. Give the matter to senior magistrate with expertise in the district court. And we are saying, yes, let those senior magistrates become appointed in the regional court to do that. We are not going to block them. If they are senior enough, they'll be able to do them special. So those are aspects I thought we basically just want to highlight, just to put the court perspective, not that we misled Parliament. We told the portfolio committee that the three courts that operate there are not from Cape Town, and that the other areas were pilotized, and they are pilotized. They were opened by the Minister of the Law in 1998, it's pilotized, to test, not civil jurisdiction, to test the desirability of establishing a special disability court for South Africa.
Can I just maybe briefly say, as a person who is serving on the Judicial Service Commission, we had a problem where there were people who were shortlisted with magistrates, and then the question of them having only experience in criminal matters has sort of prejudice to them who are going to be here. And then also, you know, the judge president can give them a hint as acting judges in the High Court. The judge president has indicated that it becomes a problem because you take that magistrate that's been there for 10 years or more than that. Now, you can't just throw him into a civil court because he doesn't have any exposure on civil matters. And then I'm mentioning this to say, I think it opens up access not only to the
but also for magistrates and all these things without having an
opportunity to receive a
better. Okay, are there any comments from members? I just wanted to indicate around the issue of we are working on the Oxfam plan, so I don't have to come back. What we want is we'll be able to give the committee a detailed plan. We're looking at money against the plan. There's money already available for the judiciary, as I have said, and we have also identified a number of problems that will be covered. So it's not that we are going to diminish the criminal and the case load. There will be adjusted to absorb the increase. There's money should be allocated for clerical staff and the registered
etc. I'm worried about
maybe
it's actually what has been touched upon now. We have a 21% vacancy as of yesterday that would be information in public prosecutors. I don't know what the exact figure is for magistrates. How will the lower courts handle this extra load of of civil matters if they cannot even cope with the criminal matters. So I'm very concerned about that. Secondly, there was no saying the law is a very demanding business. You cannot be quickly trained in 3 months or 5 months to be an adjudicator on the vast field of civil law. Magistrates can go on training for criminal law, but and people out there perceive the law as criminal law most. But I mean the vast field of civil litigation is not something that can be taught in a 3 month course or a 6 month course. It comes from years and years of practice. So that is my serious concern. For all practical purposes, taking somebody who's come out of university with an LLB because he does not practice, broadly speaking, law, he enters as a prosecutor, becomes a magistrate, and he's never been exposed to civil law. You're going to have many, many miscarriages of justice, you're going to have many, many appeals.
We're running out of time. A brief response. But can I suggest a process as well? You see, the things that you are raising, what we can put down and watch, and we let's get the implementation of program. We're going to finish this book come what we're going to learn next Tuesday. We really cannot have another setting of this. And then we're not going to vote on it for another week or so. The day we're going to vote on it is day or before that, you just bring your implementation. Can you raise those issues there? I want to check, and I raise one thing. Because it's the Judicial Officers Association, is there no way we can encourage the department? You're saying you agree with many of the things they say. In other cases, they seem to misunderstand what the bill is actually saying. Is there no way we can have you meet with them and or speak over the phone and, you know, by next week, just for the reason I say this is because it's the Judicial Officers Association of South Africa. It's their structure. And we need to get a buy-in. Even if we don't agree with them, I don't think I'm compelled, by the way. I think the points of your perspective are more valuable. I'm not very compelled by what they're saying, but I'm not even thinking of reading that, okay? And I'll speak to JB, who knows more about these things than I do. But let's see what you think. But I'm not so compelled by the argument. That's not the issue. The issue is process. They are magistrates. Whether they have a mandate or their membership or not is questionable, but we can't question. It's not our job as parliament to ask them, did you get a mandate? What's this magistrate consulting? Who are you consulting as well? Where is your own stuff and all the stuff you're raising? I must tell you, I just speak over the phone because you didn't reach me directly on my cell phone. And I told you you're running with this phone and you'll come back to us. But at this stage, can't we get the department to meet with them? And just win them over. Because they're going to continue with these views. They're going to spread these views around. Finally, if you don't want to do it, we will, that's our stage, to maybe take one or two people and confer with them telephonically or meet with them. So that, you know, the point is to wean them away from some of their misconceptions. A very quick one, because I have to get some approval for this report, I mean this program, please. And we're running out of time to change to all this.
We have already initiated a meeting with them and a discussion and the DG. It's coming to 2000, as I said, what you get most of the things. And we can get even extend the invitation to some members of the community that are available just to meet them about the issue.
But I've been
hearing
from some of the chair. And if he wants to
explain
the role, he can take
yes.
Okay, then thank you. Let us now proceed in this session. We'll do the clause by clause next week, and then also maybe the update on the training program and overview on the all in the case. But at this stage, I will hand over to the program.
Look, you've got the program. Did you look at the one called Draft Month of Distribution, not the earlier one you got from Dolly, the one I just gave out, because I've made lots of changes to it. So basically, can we just quickly go through the thing next week we adopted, okay? I'm sure Lolly and particularly Christine will be impressed with the title, because I guess when Christine gets a bit overwhelmed. And we're telling her, we too have energy, Christine. Too much of legislation, too little oversight, too little time. But we have to manage. That's our theme for the year, right? You can change it if you want. But the study group, we, you know, obviously we go through the NC processes, we agree to it, they're not just for the title.
Okay. Now, basically, last year, remember, we had up to 5 reports. And we're trying to strike a balance between oversight and legislation. The truth is, we're not going to be able to have much oversight this year. So we're going to focus on not taking on too many new things. And the 5 reports will only bound together and gave all the commitment to you. Got it? Now, 1.2 is a special year because it's the end of the 5-year term. All parliaments are under pressure. The executive is under pressure. We have a huge legislative zone that you'll see in a moment. This is an election year, and parliament will be sitting for a shorter period than usual. I think you know, Dr. Delport, Chief, that the aim is to end January at the end of August, and we come back in 2 weeks. Okay, well, it's beginning to get more than out. Okay, but the point is, there are loads of key committees here. And Bulalani, I know, is up in arms. Justice is not going to sit here on our own. And people feel that, and the deputy chief was just something to me on the content, and he was in justice. Justice is not going to be allowed to sit unless we really have to. So, but what we're going to try to do with our 5 reports is itemize things that we have to achieve, and then other things we'll hand over as an exit report to the new committee. But we say at 1.2 at the end in italics, in a sense, these reports are set targets for ourselves as a committee. So we have to monitor our own achievements before we leave in August or whenever. Okay, legislation. Currently, 2.2, we have these 3 bills before us. NCOP has got those 3 bills, we mentioned 2.3. 2.4, we are saying these are the 5 bills that are yet to come. So in 2.4, National Constituting Authority, call it the PSO bill. Renaming the High Court Bill, the Regional Court Bill, the Reform of Customary Law, and the Legislation for the Control Process. Other bills that will come, but presumably they'll be handed over to the next committee, and Lolly and Christine will presumably be here to ask those, while the rest of us will be wherever. 2.6, we ourselves have asked by nations out in the Senate to update the Human Rights Commission and the Commission on Gender Equality. Quickly, I've had lots of discussions with the Minister, Deputy Minister, and DG. And they are saying, yes, they can bring us a bill in May, but they would rather that we did the processing of the Chapter 9 institution report. Some of us are saying, no, that's only going to take place by the year 20. Let's do an Easterland change. So Johnny and the Minister are looking into that. They said, we're very short, so they'll bring it to us. And I think because we made it a mandate of our own, we must just do it. 2.7, the DSO bills, we have no idea whether it can be 1 bill, 2 bills, whether it can be safety and security consulting with us or we or some other committee, so we don't know. Budget briefings are for the 6th and 7th of May. Quarterly reports, the first one from the report on the 18th of March. The issue to follow up on the report, I'm not going to take you through it, you can go through it. The ones that are highlighted is what we are proposing we should seek to do before we end this 5-year term. And then let's go to page, let's go to 5.9, we need to reach consensus with the 5 reports, the department, the human rights commission, etc., on what we can and can't do. On the NDCC report, we have no idea at this stage for the Diwala inquiry. We think it should be expedited, but we don't know whether it comes to us or some ad hoc committee. We can't, unfortunately, I don't care about these documents, because it knows that in a previous committee, local government and public enterprises, and let me stress what to tell, about 90% of the time the funding was from outside agencies, but we've been on at least 2 funding tools on average outside the country. But that was because people in NDI and other like, you know, so frankly, I'm teasing, but the fact of the matter was, I knew somebody in NDI, and I shouldn't put that.
Let me just tell you why. They were funding about 7
organizations. No. In this space, we can go to Cuba, I'm sure you like that, and we can go to North Korea and look at their justice system and see what they're doing.
I think what we can do is to try and condense our program as much as we can. Use Friday, and then we can have a case, a very strong case.
I'll reword that, because I'm going to give this to Nell and then. Okay, we can try what we can. The details of the program, very quickly, it's there. I just want to draw attention to the second quarter, Dr. Delport and others. The agenda to follow is quite simply because we do not know what's going to happen with the DSO bill and the NDPP matter. And therefore, what we've done is we've said, please note on the last page, that the draft program, given several uncertainties, is not possible at this stage to provide specific details of the agenda from early May onwards. But those are the six or seven matters that I could see very quickly we have to do. We have to meet the Legal Aid Board, Human Rights Commission, Gender Commission, and Postal Prison people. You know, I don't know just wrong with commission. You know, we do these things, we write these reports, they get published to agency and nothing happens. Okay, so Lolly and Christine. And finally, notice Bulalani, three. The main point is on three. We've given permission in principle, Bulalani, to meet from 2:30 to 5:30. But we're not putting in our program, because then we have to get into cancel it, so we're going to play it by ears. Both the Chief Whip and Jeff Deutsch, and the Speaker also, by the way, I think has been apprised about this, and they will come back to us in a week. They said, no, in principle, it's fine. Now, the period from 2 to 2:30, please note, is for young members like Bulalani and Carol, who can have a fiesta. You know, they're young, the babies. They can't sit till... I can see them lollies. They can't sit till late. And then the older members like JJ, you know, they can gossip and gossip till late. Okay. So it's fairness. So this is the approach. And I will try to do an allocation. You can't expect me to do all of this. So each member of the committee, not the ANC, you know, will have to take one report. And this focus will be given a mandate to ring the Gender Commission, and Lori will facilitate all of that, and then contact the department via myself, that you know, to go in and do it. But I'm not going to be able to do all of these things, but we have to do it. I'll tell you some good progress. The minister says that the back of the Gender Commission sorted out. It's in the president's desk at the moment. She's nominated a person. Given three names, so that'll be sorted out. Two is the Legal Aid Board thing, right? They've come back with a very basic report that you've got here. You should send that out on the post-war visit. The Magistrates Commission takes it very seriously. I think the bars are on I think I sent it to Christine and to you. So those things we just keep in now, because people will lose it. When we come near at the time, we will give you all the responses. The department has written for 4 or 5 letters to DG, and I have exchanged with him over the phone, and some of these things they've actually already done or agreed to. I must tell you one very impressive thing. They did meet, as we recommended in our annual report consideration of the annual report, they met with the Johannesburg Attorney Association. They had a meeting with the court, they had 3 meetings. It's all in a letter, which I don't know whether I've given you, but I should send out. And in fact, they found, interestingly, that the photographs on the star on page 1, the GD told me, was a severe exaggeration. Those files are very old files. So the press is sensationalizing, but it's true what they say overall. Things are in that mess, right? The department is next, so what's the point of ranting on about it? So they have been doing things. This is I haven't had a chance to report back. But on the 18th, the DG will be here and report. One final thing. You see, I asked Christine this morning whether she'll be able to help us to do an overview of the budget before the end of March. So if you look at this, because, you know, the DSO bills are coming, and my feeling is safety and security is going to take a major role. So we have to slot in with them. So if you look at Tuesday, 18th March, we'll either have a quarterly report or the review of the department's budget. By that time, we'll have a better idea from the executive what they need to do. You know, 2 bills, 1 bill, and maybe the Speaker's office will discuss who we want. And when we'll either have the budget on the 18th or 19th of March or on the 6th and 7th of May. Look at this, please. For now, does anybody want to suggest something new? Or take out some? This is fine for now. Next week we'll have our topic. So members have got 4 or 5 days to look at it. Thank you, everybody.